Last night, I was sexting and reading June Jordan, The Desire Lines Crossing, testing my heart with precipice and crest. I was against a wall, my hands in your hair. In your kisses, I'd waited for them. I yearn for the non-negotiable abutment to the beauty of the world, the counterweight of our hips, thigh on thigh. And now I'm pulling you to the couch, a mad bitch dog that reason cannot seize, wet and wanting you wet against me. And the action is tenderness. I said I loved you and I wanted genocide to stop. And the tenderness does not stop. And this is Jenny Johnson's Bottoms, which was originally published in the American Poetry Review. Yoko Ono respected asses up close, a complete backdrop, flooding the camera, the ass as a form. A form with four sections, seemingly simple to draw, as when a child is asked to fold construction paper into four squares, and asymmetry ensues. When in motion, we notice how they tip up and down. Yours are like two globes, your words, not mine. And it's a perfect description that you see your own ass so fully, I must confess, is hot, as it's no small thing to value the back of oneself. Self-knowledge is 360 degrees, and you know too how you want each cheek to be touched. I'm a pain slut, you say, unashamed. As with any rhythm, surprise won't come if we haven't first established a pattern. Repeat after me. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Darling, if you say, I want impact, I deliver a steady pentameter.
Hello, and welcome to the Line Break Podcast and of Poetry Podcast, CrossPod. My name is Chris Corlew. With me, as always, is my friend and co-host, Bob Sikora. Bob, how are you doing?
Hi, Chris. I'm pretty okay.
Pretty okay. And what may be familiar to you if you're a regular listener of poetry, let me do my best impression of our guest. You have just been listening to Han Vanderhart reading poems. Han, welcome to the show, slash thanks for having us on your show.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Bob. It's awesome to be here with you.
Yeah.
What a delight. A crossover. That's the first for us.
Our first crossover episode, for sure.
May there be more. It feels like a party.
It feels like a party. Mm-hmm. Yes. And we're it's a more orderly party than Bob and I usually have. So we're and that's because of you, Han. So thank you. We're grateful for that. How are you two? How's Tuesday treating you? Bob, you go first. How are you, Bob?
I say this is hard. This is different.
Hard. We'll get it. We'll get it.
We will get the hang of it.
It's that
Chris,
first
I'm frazzled on a podcast day as ever. I'm frazzled on a podcast day. There are papers to grade. We are back from spring break. I said I was going to do too many things today and they're not all going to get done. And I'm very okay with that. This is a really lovely, like, pause in the day. But I'm just being a Bob.
That's
never low key. It's never like calm. It's frazzled. That's the energy and it's fine.
That's fine. Yeah. And how's North Carolina today?
Good. It's a little chilly, but yeah, it was my day off today. So it's my less hectic day. And I ran around and did a lot of press work. Nice. So yeah.
Nice.
It's always a good day when you can get to freely do the labor of love work that you have to
good
do.
Labor, yeah.
Yeah. And I discovered that like you really need to write a separate list for your self-care, like taking a shower and doing yoga and your meds and all that, or else you will not take care of it. So I did that today. That felt good.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good. Good. Yeah.
How about you, Chris?
Well, I've been off working out for a while. You were talking about yoga, but because I was sick for the last couple of weeks, but I spent 34 minutes on the bike today as the timed by the album I was listening to. And I only sort of hurt. I played basketball on Saturday too. So I only sort of hurt. And I didn't write poems today, but I wrote poems at 11:30 last night. So that almost counts as today.
There we go.
So, mm-hmm. So it's been, you know, a good 24 hours, I would say. Should we talk about poems?
Let's do it.
I think it's what we're here for.
You might be right. You might be right. I don't know. So yeah, listeners, we are going to do something different. We're hybriding our two shows in that you said on the last episode of A Poetry Hand that that we inspired you and Amorak to read your own poems, but I don't know. I feel like you guys on A Poetry, you read, well, maybe it's because you read so many more poems. You guys are just like just poeming. The whole podcast is great. Bob and I were so
prolific. Yeah.
So yeah, we're going to read one of our own poems, each of the three of us, and then a cover poem. And then we're going to do the line break bridge troll three questions. So Han, why this Jenny Johnson poem? Why'd you bring this one today?
So Amelia Phillips, who just, their non-binary Bird of Paradise book just came out from University Akron Press.
What a title.
I know, it's so good. And the cover is really beautiful too. We ended up talking about a lot of queer love poems on their episode of Poetry, which actually hasn't aired yet. But this poem came up along with Jenny Johnson's fisting party poem in the Cortland Review, which is incredible. Go read it. I'm probably not brave enough to read it. Bottoms, if you noticed by the end, I was blushing. I was so pink by the end of me. This even, like, you know, I think it's good to like push ourselves a little bit and be like, I'm gonna challenge myself. But yeah, I looked up this poem because I had not read it, and it was beautiful, and what it was doing with rhythm, and then that, oh dang, like going to Red Key Theater, Red Key, with I Wake to Sleep and Take My Waking Slow, that acts as a disruption, right? I was just like, this is an amazing poem. I have to share this with someone. So thank you for listening.
As good a reason as any.
I can speak to our theoretical listeners' experience, though. I pulled up the poem, so I wasn't watching you read it. I just had the poem, and I was listening, and I heard no blushing in your reading. It was a really lovely reading.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is. It is a. It is an incredible juxtaposition. Your world-renowned soothing voice with Yoko Ono respected asses up close. You know.
It's incredible.
But yeah. Yes, I think your impulse that this is a form. This is a literature as a whole is an art form where every once in a while we should challenge ourselves a little bit. I was just talking to a novelist who was like, the first note he got back was like, much worse needs to happen to this main character.
Wow.
And you know, it wasn't like, it's not like the book wasn't like Seven or Saw or whatever, but it was just like, you know, a novel where a bunch of bad stuff happens to a weird little guy. And, you know, it's like, yeah, sometimes we need to write / read things we're a little bit more uncomfortable with. Mm-hmm. So I like the impulse.
Yeah. And she's, I mean, Johnson, and actually, as I say that, I do not remember. Okay. Looks like she does use she, her pronouns. I just wanted to check before I open my mouth.
Always worth doing, yeah.
You know, using such a traditional form, like using stanzas, yeah, using quatrains, yeah, like, do you know, calling out, if you're going to call out pentameter, right? And, you yeah know, doing that, it takes expertise, and it's, I guess maybe it doesn't take expertise, but it's definitely evoking that expertise.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's such
it takes the
poem,
the craftsmanship of sitting with it. You know, you're sitting down, and you know, these are all quatrains. Mm-hmm. This is like a very orderly poem, given the content. Take us a bit further into that. What's the move for you? Is it that attention to rhythm and detail, or is it something else?
I mean, it's definitely partly the appropriation of Red Key. And I mean that just in the sense of, like, not in a negative, but in, like, using it, you know. I like to do that with Robert Frost, and have joked. Well, I like to bring Robert Frost Silken Tint sonnet into readings I give if I'm reading from a particular manuscript that does a lot with, like, eroticism and desire. And I joke that he's America's foremost bondage poet, because Silken Tint is so about constraint. And Robert Ross is so about constraint and form, right? And in line 4 in the Jenny Johnson poem, you get the ass as a form. And, you know, so Johnson is just playing with form, literally, physically, like the whole poem. And then to, you know, lift this kind of well-known, renowned line, and drop it in and to say, like, I'm using it for something. Like, the speaker is like, I am using this to measure this, like, physical contact and to, like, use this rhythm with our bodies. I just think that's incredible. And I mean, the last line, it kind of makes me gasp a little bit. A steady pentameter. Mm-hmm. It's just like, this is not your high school poem. This is not the poem. You got the Robert Frost. You got the Theodore Redke. You did not get Jenny Johnson's bottoms. And so it goes out into the world making a much better place.
And we do imagine a lot of our listeners to be picking up where high school poetry left off. So this is a great. I love
it should Frost's... be a high school poem, but
absolutely. They're ready.
I mean, can't you see telling like a room full of kids, you're like, let's read Bottoms. They'd be like, what?
They'd be so into it. Yeah.
They would.
So into it.
They so would. You're speaking directly to truly, like, the one of the major, like, regrets of my life. And not I don't feel like it fully is regrets, but I was a high school teacher for 4-ish years. And the times I got to teach poetry, you know, like the things that as like a 20, I was like a 24 year old teaching high schoolers. It was a terrible idea. But, you know, like the things that I thought were pushing the boundaries or like were exciting, just like, I wish I could do it all over so bad, you know? And, you know, I'm sure I was doing a better job than like some folks have gotten for sure. But I'm mad I didn't bring this poem in. You know, I wasn't bringing this in. That would have changed the classroom so much.
Probably would have been total chaos. I mean,
it's also that, yeah.
They're so ready to go full feral. I just, as a parent of a middle schooler, it's some wild energy. So probably it would be terrible.
No, that is a good point of like, you take that band-aid off and they're like, nope, we're all right. We're going to really talk about it now.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Because some kind of permission is definitely part of this poem. And I think the reader gets that. Yeah.
But I think you're so right of like what a that juxtaposition between the content and the form is. I don't know. I feel like it's such an interesting way to like that the poem is like making me talk and think about poetry, you know, and I love that. And that feels like the right poem for a class where you're thinking about, you know, I am thinking about some of my students right now who resisted against our early in the semester poetry. And how much something like this says, you know, one like does give that permission of you can talk about anything, you can write about anything, and also that you can write about it kind of like you're saying, like with some rigor, you know, that it doesn't just have to be spill it. It can be very intentional.
Yeah. It can still be like craftsmanlike, and there's a certain I feel like if it's most high school poetry, you're gonna get like, you know, your Shakespeare and your John Donne and your Whitman and your Dickinson and stuff. And nothing wrong with necessarily any of those poets, but like there's a hoity-toityness to anything from more than 50 years ago if you're 16, 17 years old. And if you take the hoity-toityness out, because here we are, we're talking about ass as a form, and But you're still imposing these poetic rules, these like the, you know, steady pentameter and quatrains and music image metaphor that serves the content. It's a great high school poem. Yeah. But as you're saying, yeah, some bells don't unring though.
Yeah.
So we keep leading naturally into the next question. What's beyond the page for you?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I feel like I kind of want to go into the second question of that, the second part of that question. Like, what does the poem do for you before and after you read it? Is that okay?
Yeah. Before and after you read it. Yeah, definitely.
Because I think beyond the page, maybe I answered that already with like the Red Key.
Right.
Or sure. The, yeah. Because, right, like if you don't know Red Key, that would be, or yeah, there, yeah, I think that's one of those, it's the text it's being called on. In fact, Bob, when you were talking, I was thinking about the other line I think about all the time from this poem is, I learn by going where I need to go, right? Which is, that is the teaching line. Like,
yeah.
No one knows when they start. I knew I wanted to read it from the title. And I didn't know whether it was going to be about like power dynamics or roles or like what it was about. Sure. And then, you know, as soon as you get that opening line, like Yoko Ono respected asses, you're just like in it. You're like, and like I tell my students all the time, like, right, you still need a hook. You still need to get your reader into this, you know, whatever it is you're doing. And Jenny Johnson just pulls you straight in. And maintains that through 8 stanzas.
Yeah.
Up until the last, which is just like, it's like a, you know, there's like this embedded joke, right? Like it's landing on something that like so many respected scholars and people have spoken about, the pentameter and the natural line of the English rhythm and Milton and blah, 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 you know, all of this. And Johnson's really making it new and really doing something interesting with it, and
absolutely,
and delivers, right? That word delivers an impact, and it's just boom, like right at the end. So yeah, I think it's kind of, it's one of those erotic kind of explosive, yeah, it's kind of like a surprise element for me at the end. I think I was not expecting the Red Key. I wasn't expecting those verbs, and the pentameter close, because pentameter doesn't sound like a very sexy or sensuous word.
Yeah.
But there's so much sensuality and form. And the 17th century poets knew it, who were working with sonnets, who were working with pentameter, like they knew it.
Yeah.
Poets have been the same for a really long time.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. Oh.
Yeah,
that's great. And I came away thinking the end, almost, you said the end almost surprises you. I came away thinking this poem was like exactly the right length, almost. You know, any shorter and it might be like, it would risk being a little jokey, and any longer it would risk being a little like overwrought, overwhelming. But yeah, it's a solid 8 stanzas, all quatrains, and it treats its subject very seriously, and treats the craft of the poem very seriously. And yeah, if I think if there's any more or any less, it wouldn't be quite as effective.
Yeah, I agree.
A steady pentameter is such an authoritative last line too. I'm just gonna be thinking about Frost as the premier United States bondage poet for the rest of the night.
Yes. Mr. Robert.
That and like the asses form are just going to be in my head for a while. You know, I'm just like, let's add it to my list. We're going to talk about form this week. Oh, we get down to ass.
So good. It's so good.
Mm-hmm. And also, my eyes just landed on the fourth stanza, the last line, the so fully, comma, I must confess, comma, is hot, as the last line of the sentence, as the last line of the stanza. It's just great. Punctuation is deployed very well in this poem. Punctuation and line breaks.
And the language registers, right? They're all over the place.
Yes.
From like hot ass. You know, there were other moments that were just, they sound so vernacular, so spoken, and then you have self-knowledge and pentameter and globes, and you know, like you have all these other higher words, and it's
asymmetry ensuing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very pleasurable.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is a good one. What a start. What a start to the show.
Yes. we know we are fully in an episode when we've all kind of just like fallen into the poem and just like, oh, this rocks. Like, this is so good.
Yeah.
Scrolling up and down, being like, looking for things to talk about, and mostly just settling on, this is a very good poem.
It's so good. It's so good. American Poetry Review, they really do the work.
They do.
They do. Yeah.
I know they read a lot.
American Poetry Review.
And I want to highlight for our readers, Han, you read a fresh poem of your own for us.
I did.
You did.
Y'all are so brave.
Chris inspired me.
Chris, you're so brave.
I'm making up for lost time. I feel like everything I've done in the last 3 years is making up for the last 10, you know?
That's fair.
So especially, I think I read that, that actually, the one I read in the last episode was very fresh. That was like maybe 2 weeks old.
Yeah.
The one I'm reading later is probably about 8 years old, but I haven't read it except for at AWP.
Right.
In 8 years. So, you know, I'm just making up for lost time. Poems, I can't be precious about them anymore. I just throw them out in the world. And if people like them, they publish them.
Yes. Yes.
I can't edit too much anymore. I do. I'm careful about my poems, but I can't overthink them too much anymore.
Yeah. Audre Lorde has that really amazing quote about poems aren't Plato, and it's from her interview with Adrienne Rich, and she says, like, poems aren't Plato, and I realize I can't just keep trying to reshape through revision. You can't do that. You just need to write fresh poems. And that permission to just write fresh poems, because I always think of someone like Sylvia Plath, who would like revise a poem to death.
Yeah.
And then you read a poem about a pig that she wrote and you're like, that's not that great. And you spent so much time. So
yeah.
I'm more with Audre Lorde. I'm like, you know what? Poems aren't Plato. Write fresh poems.
Yeah. And like, I just did some like consolidation of like old work. Cause you know, at this mixture of old and new stuff is going into a manuscript that I'm working on and stuff. And so I had to go through old folders, some of which is like from college, some's from like, you know, a little bit after college and stuff. And it's just like, okay, do I think this poem has anything worth saving or belongs in any of these projects I'm working on right now? And if it doesn't, then I think I'm just going to have to let it go and commit to, you know, this new manuscript, write new poems. And it actually felt so nice to like, and I know like some of these are on other flash drives that I have like in the bottom of my desk or whatever, but like for the most part, like what's in my immediate workstation vicinity is like, you know, the stuff I either want to revise or the placeholders for the new stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very obviously it was cleansing practice. I feel lighter now that I've done that. So yeah, sometimes you just gotta write new poems. I agree.
All right, I'll write some new poems. I guess
you have a book coming out. It's fine. No one's talking about you, Bob.
No, I'm excited. Utopians in Love from Game.
I was
gonna Over
say
Books
we could talk about
year.
Me. We could talk about podcasting. It's a pivot point.
I could always gush about Utopians in Love. Han, have you read any of it? It's
no,
man. It's gonna be a good one. It is gonna set the literary world on fire if people have my exact taste.
Stop.
Which no one does. But
Game Over has published some poets I love, though. Like, they've got really good editorial going on there. So
yeah.
I've been really impressed
yeah.
by their authors.
They've had a very good run lately. And yeah, well, for the record, since I was giving you a hard time a little bit, and I was talking about poems sitting for a while, you stuck with this manuscript for a while. I talked you out of abandoning it.
Correct. The impulses dates back to around like 2016, I want to say. So 2016. So it took 7 years before it got picked up. It'll be 9 years before it's published. I got the exact right positive feedback at the right time, you know, for me to say like, no, this is worth seeing through.
That's crucial.
Great. Yeah. I'm extremely grateful for that. I think some of it was probably like prematurely positive. I've looked back at old versions of the manuscript and go like, oh no. but you know, maybe it's also just people like kind of having the vision and seeing like this will get somewhere and this is still in an early form. But yeah, hung on to it. And we are officially a year out. Posting a little thing about that tomorrow.
Exciting. Exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so sometimes write new poems and sometimes persevere.
You're always looking for a lesson.
Do both. Right?
Do both.
Yeah.
Do it all.
And no pressure. Now that we're talking about your poetry, now that's a great segue into why don't you read us a poem?
All right. I will read you with the title poem because I'm not reading new stuff on air.
Let's do it.
And I also sent you all the link to the published version, which is no longer the real version. So you can't fully read along with me. You'll be all right. Utopians in love. The utopians are in love. They've chartered out the next century, bought these cute matching uniforms, started peeling the skin off all our social norms. The utopians are in love. They grind their bodies against the floor, pray in new tongues. They sparkle in their underwear as they wave gravely at the sunsets in the basement. The utopians are in love. They are constantly fucking or never, ever fucking. They decipher the same ancient phrases for their own purpose, pollute the country with idealism. They craft a new life from the words of crazed pastors who keep getting run out of town. The utopians are in love and they can't get enough. They don't tire of barking across the city, gunking up the country's gears, dumping ideas for new ideas, always changing, always 30 different colors at once. Never just fairies or star flowers, but so many different types of perfection. The utopians are in love. Busy writing and rewriting constitutions. They just love writing constitutions. They're men and women, sometimes just a few, but always everyone, eventually. The utopians are charged, positive. The change is coming. The seas will turn to lemonade, sweep you up. Everyone will speak in blank verse, and everyone will join.
So good.
Thank you.
Yeah. So good. What a reading.
I've been practicing. I've got a reading coming up. So
yeah.
And then where is my here we go. I have a lot to say about why this poem, I guess, but we'll just get into it. This is What Kids Don't Know by Jill McDonough. I visit a high school. And the high school kids ask if I still write poems for Josie. I didn't remember. Kids don't know the grown-ups all around them are in love. Their schlubby principal in his cluttered office. Tired cafeteria ladies in hairnets, smelling like tater tots. All these coaches and waiters. All the doctors and great aunts. People working drive-through windows. They smile. They hand you paper cups filled with popcorn ice. They were up all night in bed with someone they can't get enough of, can't stop thinking about. They're making some mental lists, enough going on upstairs to last all through a double shift. Your librarian is writing a love letter. She is smiling, saving it on her laptop, sighing. And now she is touching her lips.
Yeah. Good poems, Bob. Great choices. This one rules.
They go so well together, too. Dang. That's an amazing poem by Jill.
I know.
Yeah, that rules.
Dang.
This is one of those poems that makes me think, oh, it's not so hard to write a totally breathtaking poem. Anyone can do it. But then it's one of those, like, it screams the ease of writing that you know wasn't there, you know? Yeah, this rocks, Bob. Why this poem? Why'd you bring this one? You got a lot to say.
Yeah, I'm realizing I'm, as we classically do on the show, I'm going to conflate all my answers here. I'll start with a simple version. As we said, I'm very much in countdown to my book mode. I have been kind of energized in the, like, all right, how am I going to get people to think about this? And I just had an email conversation with Jill recently. She was one of my grad school professors. And I just had that moment where I was like, oh, I read this poem, like, I don't know, half a year ago, and I loved it so much, and we haven't talked about it on the show. So I want to talk about it today. That's
as good as reason.
That's kind of short of it. Yeah, as I said,
I do like you looking back at one of your mentor's poems while you're thinking about publishing your book. There's something very nice about that. Hey, and you talk a lot about being cognizant of your literary lineages and stuff like that. I think that's a good move, Bob.
Yeah, and they're both in couplets, which, right? Like, one of the hottest forms.
Oh, yeah. Among the sexiest, yeah.
Wait,
I heard a Beholding reference on of poetry recently, and mm-hmm. something we love to gush about over and over again.
You've heard the description of the couplets, like, this is kind of corny, but, like, lips, like, they can be facing each other, the couplets, and in terms of grammar, or if they're belonging to different sentences, it's like they're facing away. Like, so there's like such a dual dynamic in the couplet. I think it's,
I had not heard that. That rules.
I feel like I've heard close, but not the lips. That's great. You're reminding me of when I last reread Beholding, you know, I posted on Instagram, and a friend of the pod, Maya Williams, just commented on the post, all caps, couplets, like, that's it.
I think that's what they said when they were on the podcast, right? They said, I want to talk about Ross Gay, and we're like, okay, what do you want to say about Ross Gay? And they said couplets, like that.
But Ross Gay is, like, transformative with the couplet, like the way he will write a long couplet. I mean, Bringing Down the Shovel, the incredibly long narrative, like, right, I feel like a lot of times we think lyric with the couplet, and Ross Gay is like, let me show you what I can do. Right. But also, Beholding is a love letter. I mean, it is a love letter,
right?
Yeah.
So,
No, this is great because you're giving me all of these avenues here of how the first poem in my book, it was something I was trying to write for a while. I didn't realize it, and it was one of those things where after I wrote it, I was like, "Wait, do I need the whole book, or is it all in this one poem?" I had like a crisis about this, but I was only able to write it after I did I was living in Boston area at the time, and I wrote a book with my friend in Vermont, who was living in a yurt, spent the weekend in his yurt. But on the way,
was that Kevin?
Yeah.
Nice.
Kevin no longer lives in the yurt, RIP the yurt.
Kevin is a great poet, though.
Great poet. On that road trip, I listened to the Commonplace episode where Rachel Zucker interviews Ross Gay. I was already obsessed with Ross Gay, but they had such a good conversation about, like, why couplets. And that unlocked for me, like, one of the most important poems. Like, for me, like, a very defining, like, me poem. So it's all coming together now. It's all here.
That rules. That rules. What's the answer? All your influences coming together and birthing your book.
Bob, it's been a minute since I listened to that episode, I think.
I mean, that's another one where, like, we were talking before the show of, like, you need to put it in an archive. It's so good. Mm-hmm. I also, it's been a long time for me. I don't even fully remember, like, what I latched onto so much, but, like, the sentiment of what they said just, like, overtook me. It was so incredible.
I'll have to go back and listen. I was like, can you tell us what that was?
But I don't know what the secret was, but it was there.
I got the magic, the secret to couplets. Don't remember, but amazing. You know, now we'll all have to go listen.
That's, right.
You know, listening party.
Yeah. Also, audience, please go back and listen.
The magic of couplets, the secret of couplets reminds me, I think I had a shower thought today that like writing is like, I had a vision of like writing the way TV chefs talk about like cooking dishes, you know? And it's like, well, you need to add a little, you know, you need like a dash of cayenne pepper because it plays really well with turmeric or whatever, you know, and like you need a couplet here because it's going to set up the quatrain two stanzas down or whatever. Like, I don't know, sometimes I get these non-writing visions of like how to think about writing, and it's silly, but keeps me from getting stale, I guess, you know.
I love the poetry cooking reality show in your head that is
you know, some of it's Sola Alwehi, some of it's Emeril, some of it's Bourdain, most of it's Bourdain.
Oh my.
So let's dig in, Bob. What's the move in this poem?
That's the part I feel least prepared to talk about, and I think it does go back to what you were saying of you know, to me this feels so classically like, you know, I know the two of us love so much of that poem that feels easy, like you said, and that, you know, there was labor and care put into this.
Yeah.
I think the single moment for me is probably with the exclamation point, people working drive-through windows. Like the whole poem has like led to this moment, and that, like, that is what can be exclaimed right there in the middle. I have been fully swept up with you, and I agree. And I'm just like nodding with a smile on my face at that sentiment. Like, it's this person, it's them too. Like that moment of it all coming together, it just blows me away.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good one.
It also like walks this line, right? Of like, I mean, there's always an accusation somewhere near around poetry about sentimentality, but like, yeah, who doesn't want this? Like, this is so good. Like, it's like the right amount of sweet and the, like, it's the salt, you know, it's just like, oh, cooking has started. Oh no. You know, salt, fat, acid, heat. It's got it.
No, absolutely. And like, it's the, what you're both getting at is something that's, you know, this is probably completely inappropriate language, but like, you can get away with a lot of sentimentality in poetry if you just like put your own like brand of dash of like crazy in it, you know, like if you're like, cafeteria ladies, you know, they smell like tater tots, and you know, they smile, and like coaches, you think about waiters, people working drive through windows. And I just like, I picture myself in a room with the speaker of the poem, who we all know is not Jill McDonough, but is, you know, we're all saying that the speaker of the poem is not the author because we tell lies to each other as a community. But you know, you just imagine yourself in the room with the speaker and being like, yeah, I like hanging out with this person. They're like, they're my kind of weirdo. It's like where I get a lot of my favorite poems from. the break in the enjambment, I just have to point this out, and then you go, Bob, but they smile, they hand, stanza break. Drive-through people are always handing you stuff. And so the next stanza image can be whatever. And she goes with paper cups filled with popcorn ice. What a great image to land on after the stanza break. It's awesome. Sorry, Bob, you were saying.
Just all detail. So good. I was just going to take us into the home stretch question, because I do feel like that's where I have the most trend. Yeah, and you know, a classic kind of funny thing where I'm like, I don't want to kind of rush over the moves and the craft of the poem, but I do feel like it is for me so much the beyond the page here, at least in this moment. Like I said, I was thinking of Jill and her work, because we just were emailing. But yeah, like at this, you know, kind of moment in my career where I'm thinking about my work and stuff, like to come back to a poem like this and seeing it do all of the things that I strive to do in my work, and kind of recognize it, yeah, like I guess I'm just like having one of those moments where I can like really see that lineage, have a lot of gratitude for younger, dumber me who didn't really know what I was doing when I was going to grad school, and like that I wound up at a place with someone like this who I think their work resonates with me in such an incredible way, and gave me a lot of permission to kind of be myself. And I, you know, yeah, like we've definitely talked about this before at some point, but I'm not that afraid of the sentimentality. Like I know that that concept is out there of wanting to resist sentimentality. I never had someone, you know, tell me not to use the word love in one of my poems. And so I use it in practically all of my poems. And yeah, there's a lot of like, yeah, reading this poem, it gives me joy on the level of the content. I'm so happy this poem exists, and that it, like it's a weird poem in that it's not necessarily like making me see something I didn't see before, but it's like reminding me of something that's so important. Like what's so funny to me about this poem is like that it kind of puts you in the position of the high school kids who are like, oh yeah, I do know this to be true, but I don't spend my days remembering that everyone is in love. And I love being awakened to that so much. And I see, and now I'm out of thing. I have too much, and someone else speak, please.
It's a poem as a glass of water for you, you know.
Oh,
the sustaining poem.
Beautiful.
It's, and you get so caught up in it, like
mm-hmm.
you're so yeah. into it that you forget how weird the opening is. Like yeah. What? I visit a high school, and the high school kids ask if I still write poems for Josie. Never comes back to Josie. No. And then instead
literally
of saying,
the first I thought of it.
Yeah. And then instead of saying, who supposedly it was some kind of relationship, right? Like, I didn't remember, which I find that verb tense so weird. Like, yes. Why isn't it I forgot?
Yeah.
Like, what? I don't know. It's so weird. Like, I didn't remember. So, like, they knew it, but then they forgot. I don't know. It's quirky and like, really love it, like that kind yeah. of like weird friction, like why is that there? It, but yeah. It's not in a distracting, it did not distract me on the first three through, only subsequent, which I think is like when you're weighing like is this too distracting or should it stay in or go, like well right. The first time I was fine, but looking at it now it's just, you know, like yeah, it's something, I don't know, it does something really weird with time or knowing and forgetting and being present with the children. And it's something about the children, and it puts you in a different mind frame. And then you see a little through what, like how they look at the world. And then you're like, oh, you know, but.
Yeah. I'm so glad yeah. you brought up time here. Because that's another, I don't know, thing with me right now is I think I used to talk about, my work is like, I was secretly always writing love poems and like, that was my thing. And then I found this content and this language of utopians, and I do this work with these historical people. And I was like, oh, that's the thing I'm obsessed with. And secretly I'm working on an essay right now. Haven't done this in a long time. And I think I've changed my mind. And I think actually like time is the thing I'm obsessed with. And I'm always writing about time. And I'm having like a really fun time like excavating that and trying to understand what that means. So like that moment there that you just picked up on, and like yeah, I'm like yes, I'm yes, like time is even here too, and I can't stop seeing it. It's my matrix right now. I'm just
oh, yeah.
everywhere I look.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I think if you can find something that's like generative and capacious for you to have a way of thinking about your manuscripts, mm-hmm. whether several or many or just one, or like with talking with a Morak of poetry recently and realizing that it's like, for me, it's genealogy, and it's mm-hmm. always going to be yeah. genealogy. It's like this yeah. family tree filter effect. And yeah, that's like really, it, again, form, you know, coming back to like the form.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved that on that episode with the talk of genealogy. I'm always thinking about like with the different projects I'm working on, like, oh, so this one I'm definitely like, I've got you know, my list of four or five books or whatever that are like, I think Bob and I have talked about it, and like, what's the existing book you're trying to write in or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. And like that conversation of lineage. I think that's something that's really like, seems really important to me, is just like an honoring those who came before you kind of thing.
Right.
So yeah, I like that you brought that up, and especially how you brought that up in the, in conjunction with like thinking about a manuscript, thinking about a project, like who am I talking to when I write this? Not just who's going to read it, but who am I reaching back through time to talk to?
Ugh.
Although Bob, I have to say, you were talking about time. I was talking about geography. Is a physics textbook.
Oh no.
Gotta start putting some math in your poetry, I think.
That'll be the day. Oh my. Enough about me. Can we move on?
I can read some poems. I have some.
Yes.
Yeah, like I said, this I wrote probably actually 12 years ago. I maybe read this at a reading we did at Dipcento, Bob. Maybe,
okay.
But I don't remember. Yeah, it's a short poem, so we'll just get into it. Human pastoral brick. Willow white duck, the blistered spigot squirts not only for you, but for my irradiated necktie and the brick-licking light making a flower fortress of bright wire to wander your wingtip's flickering basket. And then I got the memo that we're also going to do cover poems, but I didn't get it before going to pick up my kid from school. So I'm going to pick up a poem from the book I'm reading this week that I haven't started, but we'll be writing about this coming Friday, Tosca, by previous guest Elena Piscova.
Yeah.
And I'm going to pick one at random and hope it's not the one that, you know, one of the ones we've read on here before. Let's see. Here we go. Elusive black hole pair. Such a time to be alive. What comes after the ever-accelerating failure of the American experiment hangs in the arid horizon beyond you, snipping basil with beatific focus. Whenever I say let's, you say when. I mean it. This thing about the urge to go on. Your kinetic way is only to blame. I'm no longer terrified of vastness. My love, let's abscond. Find some galaxy, some town, some meadow in which to become stranger and stranger.
Yeah. Yeah.
Feel good about picking that one.
One of the poets I miss from not being on Twitter anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. I it's been months since I read that collection. And yeah, I couldn't have like snapped into that poem. I don't know it that well, but like there were moments there that I was like, oh, I remember that. Yeah. And then I just love that feeling so much. The little bit of lingering that a poem can have with you, even if you didn't memorize it, you know, if you didn't like really spend time with it, I was just like, oh.
There's a question for both of you. How many, when you read a manuscript, read a book for the first time, how many on average poems would you say, like, I'm really bad at remembering the titles of like anything, like poems or songs. Like when I listen to music, I'm like, this album is really good and I don't remember any of the song titles. So I feel like I'm not particularly good at this, but I would say like it's somewhere between 3 and 5 poems where I'm like, oh yes, that poem I'm like all in on. But then if I go back and read the book a second time or a third time, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that one. That one's good too. Or like that feeling you're talking about, Bob. How old do you read books? Or not how old do you read? How do you all read books?
Yeah, it just depends on the poet. Like some it like write more self-contained poems and I can remember them more discreetly. But like I just finished Aaron Robinson's book Wet Dream from Brick Books.
Yeah, I've seen the cover, not read anything from it.
Yeah. Very like erotic ecology, moist. It's amazing.
Hell yeah.
Very difficult to remember. But one of the things she's also writing about is she writes through like having concussed head syndrome or like this You know, and we were going through the pandemic and Zoom, and so visual screens and everything was very much a part of like the material presence in the poems. And there were like really gorgeous lines, and there were some poems, there were definitely one or two poems I really love, but like I dog ear a lot. And then I go back and reread, because very shortly after, like the next day or next evening or whatever. And it's, for me, it's the rereading, or else I feel like stuff just doesn't stick with me.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll add that to my practice, be like, I'm just going to write down like page numbers as I'm going. And then like the next day, go back and reread those ones that stuck out. Maybe that's a good thing to add.
I like that. I'm also a dog earer. And yeah, I feel like it kind of depends on my, I don't know, the opportunity cost. I'm a big library person, so I do get books that I don't get to keep. And so I do have this like limited amount of time that I get to have with them. And I have no shame dog earing a library book, you know, like the reality is some of these poetry books might not be checked out for another couple of years, you know, like if ever. Yeah. But I have that worry even when I dog ear of like, wait, am I missing one that I would really like when I come back to it? Because I do like that practice of like, let's dog ear it so I can like put some attention to it. Like I said, so I've turned into like a book Instagram person, which I feel a little bit cringe about. But also, like, to me, it is a nice practice because I have to like go back to the book and be like, what are the poems that, one, I can share on the internet, but like that I really want to and that I want to reread again and spend some time with. And that's been helpful for that. Because I agree with you. There's a funny way that I feel like some of like the poems I remember most, like I first experienced them isolated. Right. And then within the context of a collection, like the book itself does a lot of that work. And I have trouble just in terms of memory of like, oh, what were the ones? Unless it, I don't know, when it's a big old one and that sticks a little bit more. But there's so many small moments in a book that if I don't catch it right away, like it could kind of just disappear until you hear it again or read it again. And I don't reread as much as I should.
Yeah.
I want to be a better rereader.
Start blogging about your books, man. I'm going to keep telling it to you. Start blogging about your books.
We'll get there. I had a follow-up question that was aimed at you, Chris.
It's not why did I pick this particular poem, Lena, is it?
No, but I was just thinking in general, I just want to praise Alina some more. And knowing that you enjoyed the poem I read, you enjoyed talking to her, anything that stands out for you right away? You know, like you hear the Sure. Alina poem, what grabs you?
So with everyone who comes on the show, I try to read a lot of their work before they come on the show. But frankly, especially in the early episodes, Bob, you're the person who knows people. I'm starting to know people, but Bob, you're the person who knows people. So it's usually you bringing someone to my attention and me being like, all right, what do they got online? And then, cause you know, and I, with everyone who comes on the show, I genuinely have liked everyone enough to like think to myself, I'm going to buy this book eventually. Sometimes someone's work sticks out to me enough that I'm like, okay, I'm going to buy this book like right away. Alina was one of those, I think maybe because you read her poem and then she came on the show. So yeah, I've had this book for about 3 months, and it's, because I blog, I schedule out my reading list a few months in advance, and this was up for this week. I'm doing a novel and a book of poetry now lately, and it's kind of a little too much, but right now I love it, so I'm gonna keep doing it until the wheels fall off, which will probably be when my kid's out of school for summer. So yeah, I haven't gotten to this book yet just because I was it came second, and I picked this one because it was one page long, and the title grabbed me, Elusive Black Hole Pair. And I think there's something cool in the form that echoes a little bit of what we're talking about with ours, where it's got, you know, one line stanza, five lines. And then at the end, beginning with my love, let's abscond, find some galaxy, some town, some meadow in which to become stranger and stranger. It's just like single lines straight down the end of the page. I love when poems do that, have like a cluster and then like kind of they stretch out, you know. Or they stretch out and then have a cluster. Just like a tone shift in poems that I really like. One of the ones I was writing at 11:30 last night does that, where it's like three couplets and then like a 10-line stanza and then like another couplet to take us out or something like that. That's just a fun move. So of things that stand out right away, the why is I picked this poem because it was one page long and I turned to it. And the move, I guess, is the tonal shift, or the cluster of words shift, I think.
Yeah.
And Chris, wasn't there some shared language between that poem and Human Pastoral Brick, your poem?
There might be.
I thought I heard some like nouns or like the light, or there were some things that I was like, wait.
It is a bunch of words that you spit out of your mouth. Like, I have spigot and blistered in my poem, and there's arid horizon beyond you, snipping basil with beatific focus. That reminded me a little bit of Human Pastoral Brick.
And maybe it was just the language of strange at the end. But there was something, and you're right, like the really rich sonics, that's part of your poem, the sound. Also, I really love the title of your poem, The Human Pastoral Brick, because
it's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, it's so thick, like it's got such big, like they feel kind of like brick-like pieces. And also, what is going on? Like, there's, you know, pastoral is such a huge idea, right? But then like the human pastoral brick, I don't know, it's so full of play and so interesting. And it feels so like visual art to me too. Even while it's doing something really intentional with its sonics. Yeah, it's really beautiful.
I mean this as a compliment, Chris. My question is, was this written? So Han, we never took a class together. We had the same professor back in the day. Does this poem have a similar timeline as when Josh was teaching Harriet Mullen and really into her work?
I did read Harriet Mullen in Josh's class. This was written okay. post-grad.
Yeah.
I was going through a big Abraham Smith phase at the time. And was writing a lot of like long poems that do this, where you have a lot of words that feel like rocks in your cheeks that you have to spit out. And then I wanted to write a short one, and I also wanted to write a pastoral poem that Tom Waits might write. So I figured, what's more Tom Waitsian than a love letter to a single bird?
Well, it's hitting for me the like playfulness, but also like, yeah, like you're saying, like the language has so much texture. And it's I'm not even coming up with a good word for it, but like there's the, it's like saying the words, your mouth has to do a lot. I don't know, to me that's very Mullen-esque kind of stuff.
Yeah, I did just recently reread Sleeping with the Dictionary, and yeah, what a book to read out loud. There's a lot.
I was thinking about Gertrude Stein's, like the comments she made about a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. Like, this was the first time in 300 years that a rose had been alive in the English language, or it's something like that. I'm probably messing it up. But the brick licking light making, like that, if that's not light on brick, or if that's not, you know, it's just like, yes, like the very feeling. I don't know, one of my kids always likes to tell me like they experience synesthesia. Like, I have synesthesia with numbers. Like, numbers make me see colors. And I never know if they do or if they're just being expressive that way. But like, it feels like that. It's kind of a powerhouse of a small poem.
You two are gonna have me grinning all night, man.
Yeah, really. Send those poems out, Chris.
Yeah.
This one just got sent out. So if editors of whichever journal that was,
nice.
One of you.
Good.
Do we want to talk about podcasting?
I think we should talk about podcasting, because that's kind of, if I'm doing a Beyond the Page for Alina's poem, I was just going to talk about how grateful I feel in my that my life is so much surrounded by literature now. And that's partially because we had a kid and couldn't afford childcare, so I had to stay home. And my wife makes enough money for that to be possible, which is great. We're not rich by any means, but I can sort of write poems for a living. And feeling grateful, hand to you for us doing this. And like, also just like, I don't know, like I was saying earlier, like I feel like I am like in the community now, and like, that was the initial goal of this podcast, was to force myself to read more poetry and to ingratiate myself into the community a little bit. And I'm just like in the year 2024 starting to kind of like feel like I'm leading a literary life. And so for me, the podcast motivation was really just to like force myself to think about poetry. But Han, you already teach and as far as I can tell, you have a book published. You have no problem writing. Like I had problems writing for a long time. What pushed you to podcasting?
You know, it really was the pandemic and being home and, you know, home with our kids.
Yeah.
And at the time, I think I just resigned from a job that was not a good fit for me.
Sure.
The huge story there about teaching Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Are Watching God. And the short story is I told a student that they had a kind of a white reading on the text and kind of blew up. It was at a private school, which I found later. Cool. Yeah, there's like a whole story there. I've written a whole way too emotionally involved essay about it. Anyway.
I love that book, by the way, and don't have very much tolerance for people who don't like it.
You know, I seriously think if you don't like that book, I feel like David Lynch here, like fix your hearts or die. Like, what's wrong with you? You think you characters are unlikable? Like, what is wrong with you? Like, oh my God, love story. Oh, so good. Some of those beautiful sentences, like you just the opening sentence of that book, you could sit with forever. Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh my God. And I am like not a fan of dialect writing, but when Zora Neale Hurston does it, I really appreciate it because it just sings off the page. You feel like it's like, you feel like she spent her life collecting folklore stories from North Florida. Like, God, I love that book. And I love her like whole life project. I've read the only other book of hers I've read is Every Tongue Got to Confess. But yeah, she rules. So yeah, I'm with you. Fix your heart. But sorry, you were saying more. You're saying
It was just that my book was coming out and it was supposed to come out in 2020 and then it was put off another year, which felt very, very long because I'd been waiting. But you know, these things do take a minute sometimes. So when it came out in 2021, I really wanted to do something to help poets with promotion of their books.
Yeah.
So many people had books coming out and suddenly you could have no readings. You were at home. There were no book tours. And we did get Zoom and we kind of cobbled things back together, but there was a big learning curve with Zoom and
there was,
you know, and access, right? Like you have to have good internet, you have to have equipment, blah, 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 blah. So much. And you know, teachers were having to learn how to put their classes entirely online overnight. Like the demands, the labor demands and the disregard for people's mental and physical health and well-being was just at a low, such a low. So it really was to be in community with other people and help folks get their books because, you know, into the world a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I was the reviews editor at Ecotheater Review for a few years and I would write long form book reviews and feel like they were getting like 10 readers. And I would spend weeks writing these things and very invested and I love the work. I love it. But a podcast is, you know, we're all so read out of our minds or like we were so tired and listening to people talk like David Naiman on Between the Covers and Rachel Zucker on Commonplace Pod, like it put me in company with other people and it made me feel like I was surrounded by others even when I was not. So it really felt like it was such company. And yeah, I know I'm not the only person who like kind of fell in love with podcasts during lockdown, especially.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it just kept going. And now it feels like one long conversation.
Yeah.
But absolutely. It
really connects you with other people.
Right.
In a huge way.
100%. That was back in 2016, when I was drunkenly pitching the show to Bob at every party we would go to. I was working in a bookstore at the time and I was working in the warehouse. So I would go through boxes of used books and see what goes on the shelves, what goes on the internet and what goes in the recycling. And then I would pack up the shipping orders and send those out. And that was my job. And I would sit down in the warehouse mostly by myself and I would just listen to podcasts all day. And it was like a perfect job because I was around books and I just listened to podcasts all day. But I, you know, this is back in 2016, and like, I don't know, I had my sports and comedy podcast that I listened to, and I was like, if I just knew about, or if they were just poetry podcasts, you know, I would be so much more involved in like literary stuff. Now, did I go looking for poetry podcasts? No, the aforementioned trauma blocks and whatever. But I kept saying to Bob, like, hey, why don't we just talk about poems into a microphone? and record ourselves and make us do it every, you know, however much we're doing it. And yeah, it's a way to get community. And for whatever reason, well, you brought up like reading reviews. I read a lot of articles and stuff. Like, I'm constantly just like reading the internet, but I realized that most people don't spend their lives that way. And I was thinking, like, when I had that warehouse job, like, a lot of people are just like looking for distractions while they're at work.
Yeah.
Why can't that distraction be a poem?
Can That's I really ask? Funny.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Bob.
It was just funny to hear the timeline as you describe, and not that I'm questioning it. I'm just, time is feels awful right now, because 2016. I don't know. Whenever it happened, but yeah, you were bringing this up, and I had just had no idea how serious you were. You know, so I was just like,
admittedly, with me in 2016, it's hard to tell how serious I was about anything. Back then.
The trouble too, I was like, wait, I wasn't living in Chicago in 2016, but somewhere around those years.
Somewhere around that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And then, of course, so we started recording some episodes. Your computer dies. We lose all the episodes. And now we're flashing forward to like 2020, and very similar. Pandemic has started. I think we started the podcast not knowing I was about to move. Then I move. So there's a way that podcast has just been like a way to keep up friendship and like to keep us both talking about this kind of stuff. But I think it's really funny, kind of, Hannah, what you're saying too. We definitely initially were incredibly bashful about inviting anyone on, you know, and like started, probably Adrian was our first guest, who's like a mutual friend of ours.
It was either Adrian or Chloe. Yeah.
Right. And I think I know I'm still pretty bashful about it. Chris, you're getting more.
I'm getting bolder. Yeah.
Yeah, he keeps getting bolder.
Once Jose said yes, I was like, anything's possible.
Right, it's true. That's right. We had one of the poetry gods on our podcast. But it is so funny how, I guess, like, what I'm trying to get at is, I think I knew this to be true. You know, probably essentially be like because of grad school, you know, like I had met all of these poetry people, and I did see how quickly being in community with some folks who do this work, that you start to root for each other. And I didn't realize how much we have someone on the podcast once, and oh, we are way more entangled, and curious about each other's work and excited for each other in a way that, it rocks. It's so great. I was not expecting it at all. And it's really lovely.
That's heartwarming for me to hear, because I thought I was being annoying when I was fishing. But Han, when you were talking to Amorek on the episode this past week about like why y'all started the press, mm-hmm. I was listening to that whole conversation thinking, yeah, that's a lot of the same thoughts I had about the podcast. Is like, yeah, and like Bob, you're talking about the entanglements, like all of a sudden you just have like this circle of other writers that you know, and I don't know, it feels like poets can't help but support each other.
Mm-hmm.
When did the idea, since we're talking about being bashful, when did the idea I can be the editor of a small press come into your head?
Ooh, I mean, I don't think it wouldn't at all without Amorek, and so it was always a we, like, yeah. We just started talking about things and we were so much on the same page and excited about the same things, unhappy about some of the same things. Sure. And I had this very strong vibe, because it was the first time I'd ever met Amorek, and it was in AWP Philly. And I was like, I could work with this person. This person, oh, yeah. We are like, you know, like when you just get that work vibe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, yes. Yeah. So I think it would be so stressful to do on your own. And so having a moral support, you know, partner, that it's really important. And very different skill sets and different gifts. And he kind of brings like the copy editing and the math, and I'm bringing the sheer optimism. Like at AWP, at one point he handed me the cash and was like, I'm going to go away, hold the cash. And I was like, okay, okay, I got the cash. No, he came back and I'd set it down on the table. And he's like, what? And I was like, I'm not to be trusted with cash. You hold on to the cash. Practically, like, yeah, no, no. Yeah. I give the hugs. I give the hugs at the press. So
these are all important jobs. Yeah. Brendan was just telling me that. He was like, yeah, you know, you're the couch guy and I'm the computer guy for Lazy and Entitled. And I was like, I've never heard that term before. And then he explained it to me. I was like, yeah, that's kind of true. That sounds right. But yeah, division of, I'm a big proponent of like an agreed upon division of labor. And that's how my household functions. You know, like we each have our rooms that we clean and stuff. And yeah.
I wanted to ask you guys how your podcast has evolved over time, or how you felt like things have changed for you, because there are some real things that just how the show runs for me and that I've kind of worked on and fixed a little across, you know, over months, because I've only been doing this about 2 years. This will be my third year this summer.
Mm-hmm. Bob's idea to go one per month was huge for us. Bob's had all the good ideas for the podcast, you know, one per month, and for the trilogy of questions about each poem. Those were Bob ideas. And I used to script everything I was going to say. I used to write out like 3 pages of notes.
Whoa.
So yeah, I think getting comfortable and going down to a workable workload of one per month.
Right. And to be fair to you, you know, again, we started during the pandemic, and truly, Han, I like moved to Kansas City. I did not know anyone. And I was terrified. So I was just in my apartment all the time, you know, so it was not that hard to record an episode every week for a while.
We were trying to do every week for a good while there.
Yeah. And it's truly not sustainable, but that we had a little sweet spot where we were able to do that. Yeah. I think there's a lot of, we got more comfortable with it. And just, yeah, like realize that like even just a little bit of structure really helped with us.
Yeah. And now we feel so comfortable. We don't prepare as much because we feel like we can just hop in the car and go, you know.
Sometimes I wish I did prepare a little bit more, but that's
yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah.
You also know each other. And right. You know how each other talk, and like that whole dynamic, like working that out as creatives together is a, like it's such a wonderful gift that you have that longevity and like, right. You know, your pauses, you know, your, you know, like you learn so much. It's always hard when I have a guest on the show and I haven't spoke, I have never actually had a conversation with them in any capacity. So the first 5 minutes we're like stepping on each other's tongues because we're trying to figure out like who's going, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I think I used to write complicated questions. And now I really like, to me that now they look kind of like gimmicky or forced, or I don't know. I was trying too hard. And now I'm just so much more interested in like, what's the work of the poems and what's the poet like interested in? And let's talk about the things like if you're into odes, if you're into form, if you're like, there's so many rich ways to talk about poems that really, it doesn't require cleverness, doesn't require, you know, you saying something super profound. Like it can just be enjoying the poems. It can, in having a poetry podcast and being like, I want to read the poems. I want the listener to hear the poems. Like poems are so visceral and they're such sensory objects. Like just listen to them. And so that's really fun. I think
that's a big part of our mission, I think, is like especially like just talking with the poems, vibing with the poems. As our friend Dianelli says on her podcast, you know, poetry's for everybody, and we want to make that the case. So like, you know, I don't know, the highest praise I get is like, you know, my friend Devin in Scotland being like, hey man, I don't know anything about poetry, but I love this podcast. Or my parents being like, we listen to every episode, we do like the show.
Our parents, you know, are our like, biggest fans.
It's like,
I especially love that.
When I was in undergrad and first getting into college, I would like show them, we'd have to make chapbooks every semester, and I'd show them my chapbooks, and I'm pretty sure they're like, what are we doing with tuition money?
Enriching the world, obviously. It always, it's, oh, yeah.
But they never said that to me. They never intimated that that was the case, but I would show them my chat books and I'm like, they're not into this. They don't.
I'm making art, okay? Yeah. Oh, something that came up for me when we were just talking about podcasts and like just the conversational style and the questions you guys have, which I think are awesome. I love that you've like honed them into these really cool. I still have questions about what's going on beyond the page, like, because that question is so big and I'm like, I want to know more about that question. But also I wanted to ask you if you'd listened to Lit from the Basement, which I think is also retired, but it was such a good podcast. I loved it.
I've never even heard of it, no.
Oh my God. So it was Danielle Doolin, who's a poet. Okay.
Yeah.
And her husband, who's not a poet, and after the kids went down to bed, they go down to their basement and they read one poem together. And it was so awesome because Danielle Doolin could read a phone book and you'd just be like falling over yourself. Yeah. Like, she's such a gorgeous voice. And yeah. Then he would be asking these questions that are just wonderful non-poet questions in like intelligent listener reader, but he's like, why is that going on? What is going on? And it's just like, that was so beautiful. And I'm sad they don't record anymore, but those episodes are amazing.
I will have to look that up. That sounds great. When we came back from AWP, Mallory had all these just awesome questions about poetry. Like, why do all poets read like that? And I was like, man, I don't know. And like, she like the stuff, she, every time I've like dragged her to a reading, she's like, mostly enjoyed herself and always comes away with this like these questions that I just wouldn't have thought of and like give me a new way to approach the work. So yeah. I don't know, to me that's the podcast being successful. That's the, and like on the drive down to Kansas City, we're listening to a bunch of Bread and Poetry, and you know, and then Matt was asking questions about like all these people. I was like, we're gonna meet this person like in 6 hours, you know. And it's, yeah, I don't know. The way we frame this question is, what made you think of adding podcasting to your poetry practice? And I think that was inspired by some episode of a poetry I was listening to in the last week, where you were talking about like how people approach their practice of poetry. And it made me think that like another quote that lives in my head rent free from, my Cotton Xenomorph boss, Hannah Cohen, that like poetry is the way I approach life, is who I am. It's the way I move through the world. And thinking of podcasting as part of your practice, and then like thinking about the interactions you have with like non-poets who are listening and responding is like, that means it's working as a practice to me, I think.
Yeah. I remember Kava Akbar saying about like the Dive Dapper interviews that he used to do, like that he just wanted to really, he used the language of like getting under the hood of the car. Like, he wanted to do that with poets he really admired. And there definitely is that. But for me, it's also really important in terms of visibility and, you know, who you're having in your show. Mm-hmm. I don't want rock stars. Rock stars are incredible. And guess what? They have plenty platform.
They do.
I can ask, like, I had Jory Graham's publicist reach out to me and I could have followed up on that. But I want peers. Yeah. I want community where I am. I don't want someone I'm probably going to be really stupid in front of because I'm like fan boy girling or whatever. Like, I want to sit and talk with like practicing writers who are like in the community I'm in. Like, I want it to be reciprocal. I want it there to be movement. I don't want it to be this, I'm worshiping some person at the top. Like, I don't want that. And I know that temptation would be there for me. So,
right. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Amorak was talking about, you don't want the life of scarcity to interfere with the life of abundance. You know, anyone who hasn't listened to that episode of Amorak, QE has this great, division between the life of abundance, which is the life you get to, where you get to experience art and you get to interact with the beauty of the world and the people who have sculpted the beautiful parts into the world into a beautiful object just for you to experience. And then the life of scarcity, which is like, you got to pay the bills, you know, you got to sell books, you got to, you know, like Matt would ask me, are you networking at the book fair? I'm like, I don't think of it that way, but sort of, you know, but like, I don't want to ever approach any like any interaction with an artist, like what can I get out of you? What can you give for me? You know, that sort of thing. But like to be in a celebratory place. And if the podcast can like someone else's like where I'm at on the literary rung.
Yeah.
Or you know, not thinking too muchly and not thinking too heavily in like above or below and just talking about art.
I feel like I need to A, look up where networking comes from, the word. And B, it's got to be a better metaphor, right? It's more like a pickup game. It's more like there's something there that's like, it's more fun than that, first of all. And it's like, you're finding your people.
Yeah.
And that is such important. I don't know, like when you feel connected, because it's too easy to feel isolated. It's too easy to feel alone. Like we often write alone.
Right.
So we already have the alone part down.
Very good at being alone. Yeah. Pros.
All writers. Stars being alone. We're really good at that. So, you know, not, you know, I think networking is what business majors do. No offense, business majors. Bless
some
you
offense,
and your
business majors.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we need to start pairing up poets with business majors so someone can be supported.
This is a good point.
Civil unions. I'm not saying you have to like marry them. Someone's got to pay
coffee
bills
a couple times.
Exactly. We'll bring the enrichment to your life, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But that is a really good. Just that engagement with others, so important. And that's what I wanted to say, is that it just like, you know, yes, it requires labor from you to run your podcast. Yes, you know, going and talking to people at AWP is actually really exhausting. It's like a sensory overload that you know, you're giving of yourself. Like when you engage in community, it comes back. Like the energy comes back, the pleasure comes back. Like it, you know, to be part of something with others is rewarding. So kind of balancing that, like, what can you handle right now? What are the demands on your time? What do you physically have energy for? But yeah, such a pleasure to be here with y'all tonight. And your poems were amazing. The pairings you picked blew my mind. So
speak for yourself, man.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. So thank you. Yeah,
and I'm so stoked that you read a poem you wrote this morning. That's awesome.
Right.
Thanks.
Might have to I've been conceptualizing for both us and for Lazy and Entitled, like how what are ways poetry readings can look like in a podcast form, and maybe I'll start a reading series where everyone has to bring a poem they wrote that day. Maybe I'll do that.
Yes, a little risk. That's always good. Like, and it's so different when you're, and I miss that. I think I haven't been to like an open mic reading since before COVID, but like when you go and you read a poem and you can feel if it hits or not, you can like feel if it lands, like, and if it doesn't, you're like, okay. Or if you feel weird, like I will feel embarrassed about parts in the poem that I realize I need to revise. Right. I'm like, oh, that made me wince.
Can I tell a quick story of Bob? I don't even know if I've told you the story. The one time I went to an open mic.
Oh,
have
only
I ever
once.
Told you the story? I also just today decided I'm going to another one next month. I was voting. I was participating in democracy this morning, and the library had some like poetry month flyers. That's and there's a an open mic reading at the Rogers Park Library some Saturday afternoon in April, and I'm going to it.
There we go.
It's in Rogers Park. I have no excuse. but the only other open mic I've been to was at the Green Mill on Sunday one time, and they had a jazz band, at least a drummer, bass player, and keyboard or piano player, if not a couple horn players, but they would back whoever was reading. And hey, in the Green Mill in Chicago is like a really famous old speakeasy lounge that like has like a bunch of long running series, like the Paper Machete reading series, I think, is the longest running one. And that is not, it's not necessarily poetry. It's some poetry. It's some like performance pieces, storytelling, essay pieces, stuff like that. But this was a Sunday open mic, and this would have been in like 2013 or 14. Yeah, I was with my wife, but I wasn't married. We weren't married. So yeah, 2013 or 14. And I got up and I read a longer one of these Abe Smith inspired poems. That was just, you know, yeah, me spitting rocks out of my mouth into a mic while a jazz band was playing. And I think it's a louder poem. So I was leaning back from the mic and hollering and stuff. And you could vote someone off stage either by like, you either snap to get them to stay or clapped to get them to leave or something like that. I can't remember. And like people started doing whatever it was to get me off stage.
Oh no.
I was like, fuck, this is not going over well. Like this is, I took a chance. This is not a poetry reading. This is one of my weirder fucking poems. Why did I do this? This is nuts. And I was like, you know, I kind of started to be like, okay, I have like another page to go. It was like a 60 line poem or something. And the MC was like, hang on a second. Who wants him to stay up? And then half the bar started doing the other thing to like encourage me to stay. And I was like, 50-50 feels about right. That feels good, actually. So I finished my poem, and then I think we like finished our drinks and left. I was like, I'm not staying around and talking to anyone.
That's so high stress. Oh my goodness.
It was terrifying, ultimately validating, and I haven't done it since.
This feels very...
library would be slightly more lower stakes.
Yeah.
Library, they won't vote people off.
No, library is slightly lower stakes. But I have been thinking about it, and I'm like, I'm going to go back to that green little open mic if it still exists.
Yeah. Whoa.
Yeah, that's my only story of an open mic. I can't remember how we got on that. I'm sorry.
No, that's, I mean, that's amazing.
Amazing.
Audiences everywhere. It's very different.
Yeah.
Very different.
Yeah. I do like that. I have been thinking about that. That was like the... what you're saying, Anne, about the you can feel when something lands, feel when it doesn't, and that is its own kind of like feedback, even though it's very different hearing a poem read out loud versus like reading one. But
or Morak brought up like the 13th hour revision, which is like, I was just thinking of it now because like you send your friend, you know, your close friend, it might be you too, right? Like you send your close friend this new poem and you're like, here's this poem, and then like 3 minutes later you're like, I made a revision, here it is. And you're like, No, don't read that. It's like after you send it, then you know what you need to change. Yes. Sometimes you got to share it, and then it leaves your body and you're suddenly very vulnerable and you're like, give it back. Like, so that's really helpful too.
Yeah. I think the last thing I sent Bob was my manuscript, and I think I'll have to check the time stamps, but it was either the next episode or the second episode after that where we read a Sistina poem, and I was like, fuck, disregard the last poem in my manuscript is going to be a Sistina. I have to rewrite it. Disregard what I sent you. Don't. So yeah, I'm very familiar with the 13th hour revision.
Yeah. Well, I think we should also ask our listeners to rate our podcast. So on Apple
Podcasts.
That's
a good thing to do that we don't do.
Y'all should go 5-star our shows.
Yeah,
we'll and write something really nice.
A review would be like, actually, I don't know how to properly bribe someone into reviewing our shows. We've got one on Apple Podcasts. Shout out to Sandra.
Look, you'll get a shout out. You'll get an individual shout out.
We will probably shout you out if you review the show. If we remember to check it before the next recording, we will shout you out for sure.
Fame.
We need to. If there were a poetry podcast chart, though, I think both of us would be near the top of it.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, that's true.
I agree.
Yeah. Get on being. I'm kidding.
Well, yeah, listeners, rate and review. We also credit our music is done by Brennan Johnson. Our art is done by A.M. Strickland. What a fun crosspod. Let's do this again.
Absolutely.
Let's really do this again sometime. This was fun.
Awesome. Yeah. And I hope we didn't scare off the cross listeners, that people will be like, let's subscribe to the other podcast.
Oh yeah, I hope poetry listeners weren't
that would
like,
be
is
ideal.
This guy just like shouting his sinus problems into the microphone. As soothing as I normally experience of poetry.
No, this is awesome. Thanks so much. I was so excited to do this, and I love what you guys are doing, and Yeah, thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. I'm delighted.